evening, everybody. This is Veronica Entwistle, and you have tuned into Paradigm Shifters. And who are Paradigm Shifters? These are some pretty darn interesting people that are making a difference in the human consciousness at this time on our planet. This is a time of great change. Our Paradigm Shifter today, who's making a difference in human consciousness, has done a PhD thesis by being isolated, by living in total isolation, taking in his food and everything he needs to live, into Patagonia, is that where it is, in Chile, and from Vancouver, B.C., and through the auspices of UBC, that in itself is pretty unusual. And my guest today is Bob Call, who wrote the book Solitude, and it's Seeking Wisdom in Extremes. So welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm really glad that you're here, too, which means you made it back from your isolated experience, right?
I did. At least my body made it back.
Yeah, now that's an interesting thing to say, because I'll bet you never be the same again, will you?
No, but physically not either. It took a lot out of me. It was a hard year.
It was, eh?
It was wonderful. Yeah,
Well, give us a little bit of background and tell us what it was that prompted you to take this particular path.
You know, that to me is a question that's unanswerable. I mean, whatever prompts us to take paths, we have stories we tell about it. Mm-hmm. But when push comes to shove, the life carries us along. The world, you know, we're woven into the universe, and the universe is moving along, and we're moving along with it. So I, you know, my experiential side is that from a very young age, I've just always enjoyed being by myself in the non-human world. You know, in some ways, when I was growing up, I didn't feel very comfortable inside my family a lot of the time, or with the neighbors, and so I would disappear. And as I got older, I'd spend more and more time by myself in the wilderness, and then spent, when I was in my late 20s, I went for 3 months. It was the first really long retreat I'd done, and some remarkable changes of consciousness took place. And I almost
were you already on a spiritual bent? Were you always kind of driven on that level?
I was. You know, it's interesting because my mom was not spiritual in any formal sense, but her church was nature. And my father had become a born-again Christian, a real fundamentalist Christian, a couple of years before I was born. And so I grew up with that tension in the house. And so when I was young, I was, you know, a strong Christian, but by the time I was 15 or so, I was rebelling pretty strongly because I just didn't fit into that mold very well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there was also always a kind of a sense that I was experiencing some of the spiritual aspects of the world, but not comfortable fitting it into the Christian mindset or dogma. And so for quite a while, I just left all that behind and became a macho logger, and drinking lots and doing all those things. And then when I felt the foundations of that shifting under me, that's when I went off into the 3 months of solitude when I was in my late 20s. I just had a sense that I needed to spend some time with myself. And it was, you know, it was like I was a spectator in my own life. I watched myself buy a canoe and get food and maps and disappear. So,
I'm going to ask you this. It's going to sound kind of trite, but we're both 60s people. And I wondered if your little bits of run-ins with LSD had any impact on your drive for solitude as well.
Maybe, but I was spending time in solitude before that. You know, mm-hmm. it's just been part of my life, but certainly LSD opened windows for me. And I did it fairly strongly for about a year, I guess, and a fair amount of it. And I would go off by myself in the woods and sit and do it. And then, and those were my most profound experiences. You know, once in a while I'd go to a dance or around other people, but when I was serious about it, I would go off and sit by myself in the forest. And actually, I ended up in a mental hospital once. I did some LSD at Walden Pond. I thought I would do a tribute to Thoreau, and I freaked out. It's the only time I've ever seriously freaked out, and I thought a lion was coming to eat me, and I climbed a tree and started calling for help, and they came with guns to shoot the lion, and instead took me away. So that was kind of an interesting experience. Like,
well, I don't mean to laugh at you, but the LSD thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's so interesting. The word solitude, it really evoked a lot. As I was reading your book, which is, as I said to you on the phone yesterday, it can get pretty dry, but then it makes me laugh, or it has these bursts, these little eurekas of kind of the meaningfulness of one's inner journey just comes popping out of this kind of journal writing style you did for chronologing. It's a really wonderful retelling, you know?
Thank you.
What did you think you would accomplish by doing this? Is that a silly question? I mean, obviously you didn't know what you were going to accomplish.
I mean, you know, the whole project had multiple levels to it. So I started my undergraduate work when I was 40. I was king scuba diving in the Caribbean, and somebody wiped me out on my motorcycle, and I ended up in the hospital for a year in Montreal and came out with part of my leg amputated. And at that point, I couldn't walk. I'd lost my scuba business. And so I decided I would study. You know, I could use my brain anyway. And I'd sort of always read on my own, but I dropped out of Berkeley because of LSD, largely when I was 19. And never gone back to school. And so I thought, well, this is the opportunity. And so I started and just got very caught up in the whole academic world. But I discovered that it was really dry in the sense that it didn't have anything much to do with my own inner questions and who I felt I was in walking through the world. It was all just abstract theory and facts. And so when I decided to go on for a PhD, one of my real core issues was that I wouldn't check myself at the door, that I would bring all of myself into the academic process and integrate my spiritual work and my academic work. Yeah. And so it would be that academics would be the domain within which I would follow my spiritual practice, and at the same time weave academics into my spiritual practice. So it would be a real circular kind of a practice. And so that
was your spiritual practice at that time?
I was sitting. I discovered Buddhism after my first 3-month retreat in the solitude. I didn't know what I was doing when I went into solitude for that long and came out and was really depressed because I thought I was going to live in that kind of wonder and light forever, and of course I didn't. And so finding Buddhism was extremely helpful to me in just allowing myself to begin to experience all these ups and downs without clinging to peak experience. So, but anyway, I decided when I was doing this project that, in part it was the field work for a PhD, and so part of the reason I wrote the way I did was it had to tell the truth about the experience. I couldn't make it up. I couldn't romanticize it or fictionalize it or mythologize it. I really wanted to tell this is what it was like, because so much of adventure stuff we read is all myth. It's all made up heroics as far as I'm concerned. So I really didn't want to do that. And so that's the reason I took the tack that I did. And I wanted as well to let solitude speak directly to readers through the journal rather than, because who I am here writing, if I were to write about solitude, it wouldn't be the same voice as the voice in the journal, because I'm a different person there. Consciousness shifts out there.
Did you ever find it was really deeply agonizing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. One of the wonders is in deep solitude is everything that I experience becomes intensified. So the ecstasies are... one of the reasons I stopped doing LSD is... solitude, deep solitude, makes LSD kind of look like it's. I sort of feel like it's the difference between living something or going and watching a movie about it.
Oh.
And so, the experience of deep solitude is just way more real and profound to me than LSD ever was. I mean, I'm not saying I didn't get incredibly high on LSD, but there was always some sort of looking at a movie aspect of it that I popped a little pill here, and it not fully. Not fully the full integrity of a living process in some ways. So,
well, then when you did your 3 months isolation, you said you came out kind of shining. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I was just because there was an incredible transformation of consciousness. I almost went insane, you know, because we have an idea of who we are, right? I think I'm Bob Cull. And it typically in our culture, we get really identified with that conceptual notion of who we are, this identity we carry around and project out into the world. And we're so deeply identified with it, when that conceptual notion of who we are starts to dissolve, it's terrifying, because it feels like we're dissolving. And so if we can hang with that and go through that process of dissolution, we come to experience that we're way different than who we thought we were. We're not a static thing, a static idea, a static identity, but a living process that's essentially infinite. But that transformation, that shifting from one to the other, crossing that boundary, can be quite terrifying, because the ego is going, I don't think so, I'm not going there. And it holds on and it creates all kinds of inner terrors. And if we get caught in that panic, it can kill us. You know, panic. I taught scuba diving for a long time, and panic is what kills people. And, mm-hmm. and we really need to learn to just allow ourselves to experience whatever comes up. And that's particularly true in deep solitude, because there's nobody there to help you out. So you really need to be able to be with whatever comes up. So
I wonder, too, I think a lot of us are afraid of a lot of things, including nature, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I was reading your book and going, I think I'd be really terrified to be all alone in nature, which I didn't even know that well, and you have animals around you, and you have a lot of... So did you have any of that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah. I'm terrified all the time. Fear is a big part of my life. You know, I'm not like... That's why I say I'm not projecting myself to be some sort of heroic figure. It's not how it is for me. You know, I'm just as neurotic as everybody else, and I just get called to go do this stuff. And so fear is a big issue. And in some sense, what I try to learn is to honor my own fear, because if in fact, and this seems to be the case, that human beings are kind of wired up to be afraid of the unknown, that the unknown is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And if what we're looking to do is explore the unknown, if we say, well, you know, the divine is unknowable in some sense, it's the mysterious other, and if we want to come into the presence of that, we have to be willing to face that awe and terror. And so in some sense, that's the gateway, that's the doorway, for that if we're willing to step into that and just not project it outwards. Because when we're afraid of nature, as far as I can tell, when I'm terrified of nature and you know, the imagination, it's my own projection of my own fear. So I feel afraid, and I project it out, and then I can run away from that, and I don't have to feel afraid anymore. So I avoid the fear that way, either by running from it or attacking it. But either way, I've projected my own fear out onto the world so that I can somehow not experience it. But to the extent I can simply hang with the fear, not try to do anything with it, not try to beat it, but simply allow myself to experience it, it seems to open out into some sort of ecstatic wonder a lot of the time. But it's
so you're saying that you didn't create a bunch of defenses around the fear, you just let the fear be the milieu in which you go, right?
Well, the defenses, for most of us, certainly for me, are there. That's where I start, with these kind of automatic defenses. And the process is little by little sorting through those and allowing myself to untwist those and so that they don't have such an automatic, instant control of me and start to see through those things. And be, you know, just willing to be with it. And that's probably the key requirement in heading off into the wilderness alone, is the willingness to be with whatever arises, whatever inner joys or misses and terrors arise, and not repress it and not allow it to sweep us away, but just to kind of be there with it. And it's not always easy. And, of course, you know, over and over, even in solitude, there's ways to avoid it. You can eat something or drink a cup of coffee or stay busy with something. You know, there's lots of ways to avoid. And then
Well, let's start off you taking it in, the idea into UBC and looking for the mentors. And what was that process like? That was a bit of going into the wilderness too, wasn't it?
Well, it was. And I, by chance, stumbled onto a prof there that he's a biologist and a sculptor, and I had no idea of how amazing he was. Even, you know, I've discovered more how amazing he is since I got my PhD, because in some ways the relationship between professor and student is artificial no matter what. He's about, you know, he's 2 or 3 years older than I am.
Oh, yeah.
And I was real careful. I didn't get railroaded into choosing a committee, that I picked people from all over the university, and I got a poet on my committee and a man that was in my meditation group. And so I didn't pick people that were quote-unquote experts in the field, but people that I felt were open and mm-hmm. willing to go on an adventure. And so it was a wonderful experience. It truly was a beautiful experience. And I learned a huge amount. It was just amazing.
Okay, so once you got the permission to get accreditation for all of this, right, what was it like? How did you prepare to go down to Chile? Why on earth did you choose Chile? You're from Vancouver, right? B.C.
Yeah, well, I'm from Southern California, but I've been in Canada for a lot of years. I got accepted into the university, and my committee, what they said was like, this is a neat project, and we fully support you in doing this. However, there's no funding. You have to figure out how to fund all this on your own. And we don't guarantee you're going to get a PhD. We're not making any promises here. We have no idea of how this will become a PhD, but it sounds like a great project. And the last thing they told me before I took off, they'd invested several years of work in me, and they said, look, let's get clear here. If getting a PhD gets in the way of your own personal journey out there, forget the PhD. It's just not worth it. And that was a pretty amazing gift for a group of professors to give a student. You know, that was pretty astonishing.
Because they knew you were doing full entry into yourself, eh?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And they were just, like, very, very... and partly, you know, I was 55 at the time, and so I had a fair amount of life experience. I don't think they would have given permission to a 25-year-old. But, you know, they figured I'd been through enough that I kind of had my feet on. And I went in knowing what I wanted to do. I said, you know, everything's open for negotiation except this year of solitude. If I can't do that, I'm out of here. And so, you know, I was real clear.
And you wanted to do the year of solitude because you did that 3 months and because you loved solitude. And isn't there another investigation going on? Is there, like, what does it lead to? What is it? What is enlightenment?
Right.
Any of those things?
All that stuff. You know, I essentially, it took me a while to admit it to myself in solitude, but I went to get enlightened. And I've been dicking around with spiritual stuff for a long time, and I said, that's the end. I'm going full bore here, and I'm going to jump right into it. And so that was, you know, the backdrop of it. I went to the experiences I'd had during the first 3 months of solitude when I was in my 20s, that shift from kind of the tight egoic self into that spacious sense of being woven into the universe. And that's what I wanted to learn to control, because it was a feeling like that happens sometimes, but I don't know why or how to make it happen. And so I went to figure out how to make that happen for myself and then come back and tell other people how to do that, show other people. And so it was one of the painful aspects of the year, was having to give up that project of control and just acknowledge I'm not in charge here. That shift happens when it happens, and every time I try to make it happen, I'm just holding on to myself harder and harder, which is what prevents that shift in the first place. It's kind of a catch-22 thing. So
that's interesting.
That's
part of that letting go, isn't it? That's really surrender. So why Chile? I asked you that, and then I didn't let you answer.
Pardon?
I asked you about why Chile, and then I didn't let you answer.
Oh, right. So Chile is, between the time I graduated my undergraduate, I just didn't want to go on in a normal biological graduate degree. And so I went traveling, and I ended up coming up that coast of Chile on a ferry. and I just fell in love with it. There was it's the only place I've ever been that there's just nobody there. There's no signs of logging or mining. There's no airplanes flying over. There's no boats except in this channel where maybe four or five boats a day go through. But off to the sides of the channel, there's just thousands and thousands of miles of nobody in there. And
wow.
I thought, wow, this is where I could come back. And I happened to go up that coast on one of the very few nice days of the year weather-wise. And so I got kind of an artificial sense of what I was getting myself into. And, it turned out to be pretty stark weather. So, and when I applied, you know, and asked them down there, it took a while to figure out who I needed to ask from up here, because I came back up here and started putting this project together. And I thought about the BC coast because, you know, I thought, well, gosh, the BC coast is pretty amazing. But the more I looked at it, I thought, no, you know, if I really want solitude, I'm not going to find it in BC. There's just too many airplanes and boats and kayakers and mining and logging. And so I thought I'm going to have to really make the step off the edge here. So,
wow,
so I went down there, and I was eternally glad I did, truly, because I spent 7 weeks up coast, the BC coast, last summer in my inflatable boat, and there wasn't a day I didn't cross fish farms or see air and hear airplanes and helicopters and boats. It is just, and you know, for the year in Chile, I saw people once. There was just nobody there. And no airplanes flying over or boats. And it was just no, you know, months would go by, no sound of an internal combustion engine at all, except if I was using the chainsaw to cut firewood or have the outboard motor going. It was just amazing. Absolutely astonishing. Yeah.
And so, you know, I was really fascinated by you talking about maybe you would send for some parts to your, because you email people once a month just to keep in touch, right?
Yeah, that was my agreement, both with my family and with the university, that I took a satellite phone, and that's partly because of my prosthetic leg, but mostly because I was doing it under the auspices of the university, they wanted some kind of safety net. And
right.
Also, when I was younger, I would just disappear for months and months. My family had no idea where I was. I'd be wandering through South America. And so, eventually, I realized what I was doing and started rebuilding the connections. And they'd, you know, I had some pretty strong defenses up because I'd hurt them so much because they never knew if I was alive or dead or what was going on. And
wow.
So I promised them that I would never disappear again. And so my agreement, and any time I go traveling, at least once a month, I check in with them. And, of course, it's much easier now with email and stuff. And so
the thing I started to say was how much distraction we have when we anticipate intersecting with certain people, right?
Oh, yeah.
One point you were going to bring in some parts for an engine, but
right.
You said it would take 2 months, and that would be
yep.
2 hours, but the 2 months of distraction, knowing somebody was coming, is that touched
right.
me
and
deeply about how we use
well,
our mind. You know?
There's that, and also just dealing with the electronics. You know, of the sat phone and the projection is every time I'd go to fire up the satellite phone to send an email, my mind would, like you say, would go out somewhere else. I was no longer simply where I was, but I was imagining being, you know, hooking up out there and worrying about all this stuff. And so there was a period of about a little over 2 months, I guess, when I thought I needed more supplies because the chimney was rotted out and I needed some, you know, my boat motors had gotten drowned in the sea, and I was just persuaded that I had to have a bunch of stuff for survival. And it didn't take over my life, but I was checking my email to see if there was any news about when it might come in every 2 or 3 days. And so, you know, it was a presence in my life. I might only be doing it for half an hour a day, but nevertheless, it was a presence. But one of the fascinating things in that was, and one of the interludes in the book, because in between the essays or the journal entries, there are essays, kind of philosophical essays of exploring some of the issues and contextualizing the actual experience of solitude. And one of them I talk about desire, technology and desire. And it was fascinating that when I started thinking that, well, there were a few things I needed, and one was a chimney. My chimney was rotting out, and maybe some parts for the outboard. And the one time I saw people, the government officials came by, and they wanted to see if I was going to survive the winter. They had my coordinates, longitude and latitude. And they said, well, if you need anything, we'll be coming within 20 miles of here again in a month, and we'll be glad to come in and drop them off. And I said, no, I'm fine. And I started thinking about it, and I said, well, it would be nice, you know, to have a new section of chimney, and it would be nicer to feel more comfortable with the boat. And then the list started to grow. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. That, you know, things that I thought, well, I could, yeah. Pretty soon I had this huge list that I couldn't survive the next 5 months without these things. I had to have this stuff.
That's the shopping conundrum, isn't it?
Absolutely. It was this incredible bubble in my mind that switched from something I want to something I need.
Wow.
And when they didn't come, and they didn't come, and they didn't come for one reason or another, and then eventually, one day, I just realized, I really don't need any of this stuff. And when I made that decision that I didn't want them to bring it in and break my solitude, that whole bubble of desire just dissolved.
How wonderful.
Went, wow.
What an experience. Well, tell
it
me, what did
fantastic.
You take with you? You took everything you needed, including your food, right, when you started
out?
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, at the back of the book, there are pages of a list of everything I took. So people that are interested in you know, kind of the logistics, there's a whole logistical section of appendices in the back. And just everything, you know, the logistics of imagining everything you're going to need for the next year, not only to live where you are, but to build a shelter in the wilderness and everything you need. It's just, it goes on. And so that's a major part, you know.
Yeah, I see your list of groceries here. That's a lot of, most of it was dried.
Yeah, I didn't take hardly any canned stuff. And the food is pretty simple. You just figure out what you need for a day and then multiply through by 365 and add 10% for a buffer and then you got to stick to it. You know, whatever you figured out you could eat, that's what you stick to. So you've got to stick to your rationing so you don't run out. But it was all the little things that trying to think about that is the really complex part. So
I see you took ketchup.
Yeah, I got it. And one of the funny things, I took 15 pounds of salt for a year. And I got there, and I just went, what was I thinking?
What? How much of it did you use?
Oh, God, probably a pound, maybe. I don't know if that. I mean, you know, how long does a salt shaker last? You know, how long does a pound of salt last? A long time.
But you took more sugar than you took flour. I see that. I guess you weren't whipping up. Oh, you were making bread, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. Once a week, I'd fry bread on top of the stove and I cast iron skillet. Yep. And then that was one of my daily treats, a little tiny square of fry bread with a bit of honey in it. And I had, you know, some squares of semi-sweet chocolate and a little bit of dry fruit. And I sprouted some lentils, so I had some greens. I lived quite well. I ate a lot of fish, a lot of fish. Whenever the wind would let me, I was out jigging for red snapper.
Hmm.
So rice, beans, oatmeal, and fish, those were my staples.
Well, and tell the people about your shelter. You had a little, you kind of built a cabin, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, I took materials I needed. The soil there, the water table, when it's not actively raining, is about 4 or 5 inches under the surface. And when it is actively raining, water table's above the surface. It's very wet there, incredibly wet.
Is it cold as up here in Vancouver area? Or?
More. Yeah, quite. The ocean froze sometimes where I was.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And the wind is just astonishing. You know, it just blows and blows and rains like up here in the Vancouver area. So raw. It's cold and raw. So,
but you didn't complain about being cold very much in your book.
It was an issue at first. I write about it in the first month or so while I was still in the tent. And I didn't have any heat till I got the wood stove hooked up. there was a sense of kind of endless chill. And once I started starting a fire in the night, because I didn't build fires in the day very often, I wanted to be outside. But in the night I'd go in and I could kind of dry my clothes out and warm up. And so after that, the chill didn't bother me much. And I learned, I adapted some, and I learned just how to be with it. But at first it was, I was cold a lot. And especially at night, I just never seemed to be able to warm up. So, but then when I built the cabin too, I built a wooden frame. I built it up on a post, so it was above the ground. And then I put a plywood floor, built a wood frame, and then a single shed roof on it, so not a peaked roof, but just a single direction, and caught rain off the roof for my drinking water, and covered the outside of the cabin with a translucent tarp and the inside of it with the clear plastic, and that created a dead air space, and that was for insulation.
But it got a lot colder right after you got that done, didn't it?
Yeah, it headed into winter, so I got there in late summer, and then I got the cabin set up and everything ready for winter, and it was, you know, one of the things in terms of logistics is my plan was to staple this tarp on the outside of the cabin and staple the plastic on the inside, and I took a staple gun and 2,000 staples for the job, and I got there and I got out the staples and staple gun, and I'd taken the wrong size staples for the gun.
I'm
like, I don't believe this. I need to write somebody a letter of complaint about this. So,
what did you do? What'd you do? Glue?
Well, I couldn't go to the hardware store to get the right size staples, and so I took the staples apart one by one and drove them in with a hammer. And
oh my gosh!
Smashed my fingers. A lot, and my fingers were just split down to the quick from the cold and wet, so they were taped up with duct tape, and I'm trying to hold these wee little staples and hold the tarp tight so it won't flap in the wind after, and drive the staples in with a hammer, and of course it was just, it took forever, I kept smashing my fingers, and it was a real opportunity to practice patience, to develop patience. and also, you know, it gave me the opportunity to expand the scope of my my profanity. You know, it just
I'll bet it
whole,
did.
Whole new strings of words I'd never thought to put together before. It was,
a kind of a new channeling is what you were doing.
Oh yes.
So tell me this: how long did it take you? I mean. I don't mean it quite like that. It's like it seems like you changed deep within, as if it took you a couple of months to settle into kind of an alone space and less doingness. And can you talk
right.
about that?
It probably longer than that, actually. At first, there was just endless activity, and then I hurt myself badly. I fell and tore up my rotator cuffs, so there was a lot of pain to deal with. And I couldn't stop working to give him a chance to heal because I had to be cutting firewood and going fishing and finish the construction. And then, you know, about that time, I got to the three-month mark, and I had high expectations from that previous three-month retreat in British Columbia that, you know, once I hit 3 months, I'd be in new territory sort of a thing, and that I'd, by this time, have left all the civilization behind. I'd be really settled into my solitude. And starting to feel woven into the universe, and it just wasn't happening. And I was experiencing things about myself I didn't like that I'd seen before, but I was seeing more clearly and deeply now. Fears and anxieties and angers and just shadow, really, really powerful shadow material and that's one of the challenges of solitude, things that we normally can shy away from and not have to really face about ourselves. Right.
How did you deal with them?
The same way as everything else. You know, there's no one way. Sometimes resist and just keep chipping away at it. You know, the skillful way, as far as I can tell, is like with everything else, find the middle ground between suppressing, repressing all of this stuff and not facing it, or having it surge up and sweep you away. Neither one of those works. You know, and when you're out there, you have to be careful not to get swept away because there's nobody to rely on. And so, you know, it was a sense of laying back in the moment and allowing myself to experience all of it. And little by little come to just go, like it or not, this is how I am. This is the world. And my opinion about it doesn't really matter. You know, my opinion about a rock doesn't matter. My opinion about a tree doesn't matter. And my opinion about myself doesn't really matter. This is who I am.
And has it changed? Have you been, you see what I mean, is like with all of this awareness, is there a change in what's locked inside of you? Does it release itself in time and become a piece? You know, have you changed a lot as a result?
I think so. It's hard to know because here in town I don't experience the darknesses anywhere near as intensely, but I don't experience the joys as strongly either. Everything is buffered, but there is more of a sense of self-acceptance and a kind of one of the things that came. Because the project, in some sense, through the first winter there, after I'd been there 3 or 4 months, was this self-improvement project. I want to fix myself. I don't want this darkness. I don't want to experience the frustration, the alienation from the world around me. I want to be filled with joy and love and peace. And that's all I want. And it took, you know, slowly growing this sense of all of this that I experience as part of who I am as a human being. I'm not just the light stuff. And the world is what it is. And the challenge is to allow ourselves to experience all of it, not just pick a narrow band of how we think we ought to be and then stick to that and kind of lock everything else out. I think that's the path some people choose, but it's not my path. But for me, there's no freedom in that. And so what I came to was to start experiencing my inner life in the same way I experience the outer world, especially here in the Pacific Northwest, that there are intense storms that roll through. And we're not in control of those. And our challenge is to learn to live with them, to not always expect it to be warm and sunny, but to appreciate the rain and appreciate the wind and all of the different aspects of weather, is to allow ourselves to be with that. And that was particularly intense where I was in southern Chile, because the storms would just roll through unexpectedly, a ferocious storm. And so I started experiencing my inner world that way too, and instead of trying to control it and figure out what was going on, I learned to allow myself to be with all those inner changes.
And I love when you were talking about, you felt at times that the wind was kind of being at you, the wind was creating problems for you, and then later...
Oh, yeah. It was a malevolent presence at times, intent on my annihilation.
Yeah.
And then it became an incredible teacher. You know, it became just a powerful, powerful teacher. And then it became a friend. Eventually, I built a series of kites. I hooked them up to my fishing rod, and I'd go out and I'd let out 200 or 300 yards of line. And the kite would it was in these... Now, these are not breezes. These are winds you can barely stand up against. And the kite would soar and dive and surge, and it felt like an enormous fish on the line fighting for its freedom. And sometimes on a cloudy day, I built some translucent tarps out of clear plastic, and the kite would just about disappear into the mist. And then there would just be this line heading off into the sky, and it was though I was sky fishing for the wind. It was just this neat sensation, like this is the ultimate in catch and release.
Oh, wow. And the other thing that one of the things that I enjoyed also is your rapport with the rain dropping. Near the end of the book, it's a whole different thing. Maybe you want to talk a bit about that.
Well, the rain also was like the wind in some sense, that it was battering against me, and I was resisting it and trying to hold it out. And I wanted, you know, to have this kind of sacred little still spot inside of me that wasn't touched by anything, and of course that doesn't work. And little by little, as I learned to surrender to the wind and allow it to carve me and go out to the really windy point every day and just sit and allow the wind to actually carve me, and the same, I would sit for hour after hour just listening to the rain and allowing the sound of the rain to just come through me. and it became my kind of pathway into inner pools, inner, you know, a mantra almost that would carry me into inner stillness and into places of inner love and joy and wonder. So it was
really and talk about that is a really thrilling thing, because it seems like you became, I asked earlier if you felt changed with your shadow self and the observations and the experiences that you had, but it seems like you did. And you know what I mean? It seems like it got so much more embraced or understood, or there is a peace in it.
Yeah, and I think there is. And so one of the things is that when I was writing the book, I was speaking to a publisher, and he said, well, there's not a strong enough narrative arc here. And I went, well, that's not how it was. You know, and that notion of the narrative arc is artificial. We always look for this, a problem and then intensification and resolution, live happily ever after. And I said, that's not true. It was an ongoing process of ups and downs, of cycles of ups and downs. But behind that, there was also a larger cycle that I experienced of more self-acceptance and more acceptance of the world. Pardon?
It seems like more beingness.
Yes, absolutely. More just being with... And that acceptance also includes times of non-acceptance, because that also comes and goes. Those times of allowing ourselves to be in the world and feeling that beingness, that also is variable. You know, we dream that we'll always feel that way, and we just don't, at least most of us. And there are times we're angry.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so it's stepping back on a meta level and even accepting those changes of sometimes I'm just more, I surrender more fully to the flow of life, and sometimes I resist. And that too is part of the process.
And I want to jump into the glacier before we go too fast and get beyond that. There was a preparation you made talking about the arc of drama or whatever you called it. The preparation of maybe you're maybe not going to the glacier?
Yeah.
That was a really wonderful thing.
Yeah, the glacier was incredibly important. In some sense, it was the metaphor for the whole year of facing fear. And so I had seen where glaciers come down to a body of water, a lake or the sea, they often have a vertical face, and these enormous chunks of rock or ice calve off and crash into the sea. It's just astonishing. And I'd seen this over in Argentina years before in a tourist area, and I thought, I really want to experience that by myself out here. And so I got the charts out, and I found a glacier that came to the sea. And it was about 70, 80 miles away, and I thought, I really want to go to that. But I was dealing with this outboard motor that had gotten drowned in the salt water, and it wasn't working right, and I was afraid it was going to break down, and these unexpected storms that I couldn't seem to predict. And so there was this sense of feeling like I needed to go, and yet being prevented by my own fear from going. And I struggled with it all winter. It was very intense. And just this notion of who I was as an adventurer, my sense of self, my sense of sort of courageousness, battling with my neurotic fear. And going through all the permutations about, well, maybe the real thing is to stay here and face the fear rather than going out and challenging it on. And I just went on and on and on. And when I was editing my original journal for my dissertation and then the book, and I was working through these sections, there were times when I would be reading this stuff and I would just go, shut up! Stop whining! You know, it was just appalling, this crap that I'd written. And day after day of it, you know, just, it wasn't once or twice, it was just ongoing about how tough this experience was and I couldn't stand my own fear and blah, blah, blah. And so eventually I decided I really did need to make this journey, and I waited for a flat, calm day, sunshine, mirror calm sea, and I loaded the boat, which took hours because I had to take everything with me in case I got stormed in and was going to be, you know, who knows how long I'd be stuck out there somewhere. Left food for the cat. Cat didn't like the boat. Took off. Within 10 minutes, a storm rolled in. And the ocean was just a mess, and I was so angry, I just kept going. And I eventually, at nightfall, I couldn't go any further, and it was, I spent a really miserable night just hiding in a tiny little crack in the rock away from the surge. In the morning, I came home. But I was determined, and so I waited until it got calm again and took off again. And I said, this time I have to make it or wait out there because I don't have enough gasoline left to make another aborted trip. And it was the weather stayed calm this time, and it was just an exquisite journey. I was gone 3 or 4 days, and the motor worked fine. And there was this, I got to the glacier, and what was amazing was there was this mystic blue of glacier ice, and I had forgotten that. And when I got into the presence, and there were a pod of dolphins joined me, it was just this endless field of broken ice undulating in the sea, and then the far glacier calving off pieces. And in this ice, it was this magical blue, and there's something exquisite about it. It just came in through my eyes and straight to my heart, and it seemed to just heal me in an incredibly deep level. And I realized that all through the winter, when I thought I was facing my fear to go, it was really something much deeper than that that had been calling me to go. And so that was truly an amazing journey to the glacier.
Really pivotal, huh?
Yeah, it really was. And then after that, I didn't have to deal with all that stuff. I'd done all the journeys I wanted to do, and I just sort of hunkered down on this little island for the next month and spent a lot of time with the birds and meditating more and more, going inward. So,
what about the inner voice? Wasn't there more inner voice coming to you, coming through you?
Oh, there's a multitude of inner voices. This notion to listen to our still inner voice is hooey. I mean, when you shut up and start listening, there's endless inner voices. The hard part is figuring out which ones to listen to.
Because it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Yeah, they all have their say.
But it's interesting because you did, you know, every now and then it would seem fairly bleak, and then you'd get some message from inside.
Right.
You were actually
right.
Quite funny in the book at times about laughing at yourself or hearing these voices, and I really enjoyed those parts. I can't quote it right now. But.
Yeah, there was one place that it was reasonably early on, and that I had been going through hard cycle spiritual times, and I asked for inner guidance, you know, to help me through this. And then a voice came back and said, well, what do you think's happening, moron?
We're going to have to end this sooner than I want to, but I want you to give your, you know, how can people get hold of you, and what's the name of the book, and where can they buy it, and where are you going to be performing next?
Well, I don't know where I'll be doing slideshows next. I've done some recently, and I'm about to head off to do 3 or 4 weeks canoeing and fishing by myself up in British Columbia. Yeah,
whereabouts, the Bow Run or any of those places?
No, it's out in the Chilcotin. The Bow Run's too civilized for my taste.
Okay.
So... but I'm living in Vancouver, in British Columbia, and I expect to be here through the winter. I teach an online course in systems thinking, and so that kind of keeps me anchored to a computer most of the winter. And,
systems thinking, you mean that inner system?
Partly. I mean, it's systems thinking. It's for an environmental education master's degree. But a lot of it is about transformation of consciousness and coming to experience ourselves as part of the systems of the world.
That sounds really interesting, actually.
It's a great course. It's really fascinating readings, and the students are wonderful. They're mature students and from all over Canada and some in the States and some in Japan and different places. So it's really a wonderful, wonderful group of students every year.
So that's why you're a .org, you're bobcull.org, right?
Right, that's my website, and people can get in touch with me there. And there's lots of photographs on my website of where I was, amazingly beautiful area. There's a video on there. There's some audio stories on there from other adventures that aren't part of the solitude thing, but they're on the website anyway. And the book is available pretty much anywhere, Amazon and local bookstores, and you know, if they don't have it, I'm sure they'll be glad to order. The paperback is just out. The hardcover's been out for a year, and the paperback's out, been out a couple of months now. So,
Well, I sure recommend it, and I'm telling everybody again, it's Bob Kaul, K-U-L-L. That's bobkaul.org is his website. And the book is called Solitude, Seeking Wisdom in Extremes.
And the actual author name is Robert, not Bob.
Oh, I'm sorry, Robert. Robert
Kaul.
Yeah,
I don't go by Robert,
That's kind of connected anyway.
Yeah.
I thank you so much for our time together. You've inspired me. And is your course described on your website?
No, I don't think so. Actually, it's interesting. I'd never. This is the first time I've thought of making that connection. Because you need to be signed up for the master's program. It's not a free sign-up. So I guess that's probably why I haven't put it there, because it's a two-year program and you have to write a thesis and everything for it. And so it's so it's not just.
If people really wanted to do that, they could get hold of you anyway. So.
You know what,
Bob, Robert, I really enjoyed all you said. We could ask you a lot more, but they'll hook me off stage shortly. So I thank you so much for your time and the wonderful.
It's been my pleasure. Yeah, thank you for inviting me, and it's just been great sharing it with you and your listeners wherever they are out there.
Thank you.
Remind me,
canoe trip. What?
Yeah, when we're off air, I have a great story for you. It's just, it's not a bad story, it's just we don't have time, but it's a neat story about hidden away in the mountains of the Dominican Republic.
Okay, unfortunately we don't have time, but I'll call you back because they'll take us off this line, and I'll call you right back.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, have a great afternoon, evening.
All right, and many blessings. All right.
Thank you. Take good care.
This is Veronica Entwistle. I hope you enjoyed our paradigm shifter, Robert Kaul, and his book, Solitude. And I have to do this really fast. Thursday night at 8 o'clock, I'm going to be on with Jackie Salvitti on ET Healing and Exploration in Consciousness. We'll do Radiance by Design next Tuesday at 4 o'clock. My next paradigm shifter is kind of a surprise. I think it's part of a lightwork convention in the UK, but they haven't confirmed it yet. So that'll be really interesting. If you'd like to be in touch with me, have a session, it's Veronica at VeronicaEntwistle.com. Or if you'd like to recommend other paradigm shifters, several of you have done that recently, and I'll get back to you by email. I really appreciate that. Veronica at VeronicaEntwistle.com. And many blessings to all of us. Thank you for listening. See you on Thursday night.